You know, I think there's been a bit of a rough past when it comes to First Nations. I mean, you think just not long ago, you know, whether it's about 150 years to about 200 years, there was nobody else here. You know, it was just First Nations communities. You know, in my area here, you know, we have two different nations from Clem too. We have the Kitisu, who are Tsimshian, and they're the southernmost Tsimshian group and lived on the islands. And then we have the Hehe's people who lived on the mainland. And both nations moved into Clem too around the 1850s. But prior to that, you know, people lived, you know, quite nomadic lifestyles, and they followed the food resources on all these different areas. At the time, you know, in our cultures were very complex. It wasn't just, you know, as simple as just following food. It was, people had very complex governance structures. They had very complex relationships with different families. We had clan systems that distinguished different family groups and who had access to different areas based on different seasons. So it was a really complex relationship. And, you know, around 1884, you know, the government at the time, they decided to ban the potlatch, which was the potlatch in our community or culture. It was the glue that held everything together, the singing, the dancing, the storytelling, the governance, becoming of age ceremonies, passing of chief names, passing of copper shields. All those things were really important in our culture and our community. And people used to prepare years in advance for potlatch. So if I was going to host a potlatch, some people would prepare 4 or 5 years in advance. But the Canadian government wanted to assimilate First Nations people into the mainstream society. So at the time, they banned the potlatch in 1884 to 1951. And the same thing happened in other regions in the U.S. It happened in 1884 to 1936. But, you know, 1884 to 1951, during the ban of the potlatch, it was illegal to potlatch. You know, if you were caught potlatching, you were arrested for doing that. So at the time, you know, the government sent up what they called the Indian agent. And it was a person up here to monitor the activities of the local communities. And so everyone was paranoid for, you know, about potlatching. People didn't want to potlatch. But it was such an integral part of our culture and our community that people decided to take it underground in a way and potlatch in secret. So what people used to do is used to take the regalia, put it in, you know, the cedar bentwood boxes to make it look like it was a burial box, but it was actually their storage area for all of their regalia. And they used to paddle out to this one place we call it Dishju, and it's a gathering place for our people. And this big house is hidden in the forest. You can't tell it's there going by on the boat. And people used to paddle out during the roughest times of the year to go and potlatch so the Indian agent wouldn't follow them out there. So unfortunately, around the early 1900s, there were so many families that did not make it back. A lot of families died trying to go out and potlatch in secret. So by the early 1900s, Clem too stopped potlatching altogether. And that was a huge loss for the culture because, again, that was the glue that held everything together. And that was just, you know, one of the reasons why we, you know, during that time, we lost a lot. Yeah, I've sat down and had a lot of discussion with their elders, you know, about life. And even, you know, I mean, we live in a pretty isolated area. So it was, we didn't have actually a lot of contact. First contact we had was actually Captain Vancouver. I believe that was in 1793 when he came up. You know, the elders always talk about how nomadic the lifestyles were. They talked about the seasonal camps and the permanent camps, and they said that food harvest would start in the wintertime. It would start with the clams and cockles in the winter, and then early spring around March, the halibut would start to come in, and they would start harvesting halibut. And then once the halibut was finished, they would move over to the herring and the herring eggs, and that was huge. That was probably one of the most important foods in our community because it wasn't just used for food consumption, but it was also used for trade. And there was a huge trade routes all along the coast amongst different families up and down the coast. So Clem too used to harvest the herring eggs and trade it with the Balakula people and also the Kitimat people. And they used to trade for Ulican grease, and that was huge because we didn't have Ulicans. We're in Clem too area. So, and then once that was finished, we'd move over to seaweed in May. And then right after seaweed was finished, then you would go into salmon, in particular sockeye salmon. And then later on in the summer, late summer, you would start to get all the salmon. So the coho, pink, and chum would start to come in. So people were very dependent on all of these resources, and especially because it was such an isolated community, those aquatic resources are extremely important because food costs here in their community are so expensive. You know, but people, you know, depended on those, and they had, you know, different camps based on different things. You know, like Marvin Island for us is a herring camp. People just went there to go and harvest. herring eggs. And while they were out there, they would dry the herring eggs, they would dry the halibut, you know, because a long time ago there was no refrigerators or freezers, so they would dry everything. Everything was sun-dried, or they would smoke it, and that's how they'd preserve things. And so those, you know, we've watched a lot of those resources dwindle over the last number of years, partly because of mismanagement and people coming in and harvesting too much. And you know, in my lifetime, you know, we've witnessed huge declines, everything from abalone. Abalone used to be a once abundant shellfish in our territories, and the elders talk about it, that it was some areas, they said that you couldn't even touch the ground. There was so many abalone there. There was just, you know, they're all over the place. Today, you probably will never see one, an abalone. In my lifetime, I've never actually tried an abalone in the last probably 20-something years now, because, you know, they've all just been wiped out. You know, the commercial fishery came in and harvested way too many, and they just haven't been able to come back in numbers. And with things like abalone, you need large numbers because they're broadcast spawners. And so the population just hasn't been able to come back and do that. Same thing with salmon. I listened to the historical numbers of salmon. Some of the elders will say some of the you know, the rivers and the estuaries, they would be full of salmon. So they said some rivers were just plugged wall to wall with salmon. And I looked at the historical numbers of them, and there were about 80,000 fish in some of those systems. Today, we are down to about 5,000 or 6,000 in some of those same rivers. So, you know, I think there's just been way too much over-harvesting. And I think with things like global warming, there's a number of different impacts, I think, that are affecting salmon. So I think, you know, we have a long way to go. I think the loss of culture during the ban of the potlatch, I mean, that was huge. I mean, we had, you know, very strict ceremonies for different seasons, you know, the return of salmon, the return of oolikins, the return of herring, the return of, you know, all these different things were celebrated in a way, but also, you know, it was a ceremony to let the community know that what time of the year it was and food harvesting. I think there was traditional stories that were lost during that time, and traditional stories that taught lessons of respect for certain resources. And, you know, I think the governance structure, I think there was a lot that was lost, you know, songs and dances, and songs in our culture was a way of documenting an event, you know, that was going on. So it wasn't just a simple song, it had some meaning to it, and it came from a certain area, and it belonged to a certain family. The passing of chief names, and, you know, look, we have a very complex hereditary chief system in our community. So hereditary chiefs, you weren't just born a hereditary chief, you were groomed to be a chief. And, you know, the role of a hereditary chief is you're there to steward. You had a responsibility to take care of a certain area. And so if you were a chief, you would carry title to a certain inlet or a certain estuary. And it was your responsibility to make sure that, you know, what was going on there was sustainable. And you know, chief in our language means to serve. It means that you're there to maintain order of a house. So we had chiefs that had, you know, they were responsible for a raven house, and in that house they had to make sure people were keeping the songs alive, keeping the stories alive, you know, harvesting the different berries or harvesting deer and salmon and things like, you know, they had hunters and gatherers. So, but they would also grant permissions to certain people to access certain areas, and that was all based on sustainability. So you had to make sure that the stocks were there, and if they weren't there, they would deny access to certain areas. And we also had very complex arranged marriages as well. So if you wanted to access an area, today, you know, people just go in there and fish in an area. A long time ago, it wasn't like that. You had to get very strict permission, or it was often done through arranged marriage. So if I was a chief and I wanted access to someone else's area, you do an arranged marriage, and I would have access to their salmon, they would have access to my berries, you know. And it was, so it wasn't just anybody that can go in, and that can get you in big trouble, I think, a long time ago, if you just waltzed in there today and go and access certain areas. So I think that system, the hereditary system, you know, so a lot of that was lost during that time. Luckily, we do have some elders, you know, that still have some of that knowledge. You know, I think at the time there was this huge movement to assimilate First Nations people into the mainstream society. So by banning the potlatch was a huge, step in terms of trying to assimilate and get First Nations people to forget the culture. But prior to the banning of the potlatch came disease. So disease ran rampant in all of our communities. And we estimated we had a population of about 3,500 to 4,000 people out in Kitisew Bay alone. And disease swept through there around the 1860s. And it was a smallpox epidemic that killed off quite a bit of the communities. In some cases, it was like 99% of the communities. So we have some stories where one or two people survived the smallpox epidemic. Also around 1913, there was also the flu epidemic as well, and that decimated, quite large populations. I heard stories from our elders where so many people died that they didn't really have time to give them a proper burial. It was just dig a big hole, put them in the ground, and hopefully they don't get sick. So I think those introduction of diseases played a huge role, and a lot was lost. So not just did we have to deal with smallpox and the flu epidemic and the banning of the potlatch, communities were still around in the early 1900s, so the government started to introduce reserve systems. So they started to take First Nations nomadic people and started to push them onto these small parcels of reserve, and basically said, you're not going to live in these areas anymore, and they started pushing all these people into small little blocks. So my community was settled here in Klemtu, and this is about 100 acres here in the community. It's not very big, but our community, our territory is massive because we followed all the foods, and that's what our territory is based on today. Now if you look at our system now, we only have about, we have less than 1% of our land base if you were to go by the reserve system today. Although my people have, they've always said they've never signed a treaty, they've never surrendered rights and titles, so they've always, say this is theirs, and it's based on the chieftainship that's there. Another major event was residential schools in the 1930s. The government created these residential schools, and basically, we have some of the literature from the churches that said that the banning of the potlatch wasn't working. People were still speaking their language, people were still practicing their culture, whether that was doing it in secret. So they needed some ways to really try and get people to forget that culture, forget their language, and become, to be assimilated into mainstream society. So the idea of residential schools were created. So there were boats that came into community in the early 1930s and basically scooped up all the kids in the community, and people had no choice and they had to go. And they were taken on the boats and they were taken out to schools and they were spread out all over. A lot of people from Klemtu went down to Vancouver Island and around Alert Bay area. Some people went down to Port Alberni. Some people from Klemtu went as far over as Edmonton in the 1930s. Some people went to Vancouver to the mission school that was there. And the idea was to separate young people from their parents so that oral tradition wasn't passed on. People, if you listen to the elders that had gone to these residential schools, they were strapped for speaking their language. They had to cut their hair a certain way. They were very, the food quality wasn't good. And there was a lot of other things that went on in the background that, were not, the best things that happened to young kids. And that really changed the whole generation of kids, because now you take a bunch of kids, you put them in these residential schools, so that that love from you get from your parents was not passed on throughout families, and that had a trickle down generation. We still feel the effects today, of that generation, because some parents grew up without the parenting skills that you would learn from your parents. Some people grew up with no love, and it really it affected, households and families, communities. And so I think it's my generation is kind of the first generation that, unfortunately hasn't had to deal with all of that stuff now. And I think you're going to get this new generation that's going to come up and start to reinsert their stewardship responsibilities, reassert their authority as hereditary chiefs, as owners or stewards of the land. And I think that that's something that, we want to be able to work with, provincial and federal governments, and we want to stop, the mismanagement of these resources, and we want to work together and somehow come up with some sort of strategy to best take care of these areas.